come up and have a chair if you want.
Representative Blaine, we've got a quorum now. Are you prepared for House File 3039? Is that the one? Which one are you taking first?
Why don't we do, since it's a lengthier bill and since we don't have everybody here yet, why don't we do the land policy bill, which is House File 3056?
Okay.
If that's all right with you.
Okay, I believe we have a quorum now. Okay. We'll bring the Environment and Natural Resources Committee to order. And Representative Portman, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, I have.
From, we have three sets of minutes, I believe. Is it April 12th, 05, and February 15th, 06, and February 21st, 06? You've had a chance to review all three sets of minutes?
I would move the passage of those minutes without amendment.
Representative Portman moves the minutes of those three committee hearings. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we've got a few bills that we have to get done today. We're going to be hitting the ground running. We've got a lot of things we have to get done. We've only got six or seven meetings that we're going to be able to have before we're right up against deadlines. So Representative Blaine has some forestry issues, I think, today, and then we're going to hear a parks bill, isn't it, that Representative Osma has. So with that, Representative Blaine, you want to present House File 3056. Is that the one you want to start with?
Let's kick off the new season with 3056, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, it is my desire that before we before I present the bill, I'd like to move the AO6 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like to see it presented.
Okay, Representative Blaine has the author's amendment, AO6-1124.
That's correct.
All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I will go through this. The House File 3056 is the DNR Lands and Minerals Bill. Forestry and Minerals Bill, Forestry Lands and Minerals Bill, I guess you'd call it. Most of the issues in here have to do with cleanup language and clarifying language for existing statute and just a few technical amendments in here. It looks to be a rather lengthy bill, but there's not that much new language in there. Section 1 of the bill provides an incentive for the donation of land by reimbursing the cost of an appraisal. This also removes the DNR from the situation of having the appraisal prepared and provided to the landowner, who then uses it for tax deduction purposes. The appraising will be dealing directly on any tax issues. Section 2 basically just allows the DNR to acquire easement opportunities for road easements or utility right away in connection with state parks and state parkland. Section 3, this is a clarifying language on tree planting activities, and something that the department wanted to clean up as far as getting rid of some unnecessary language. And if you look at the bill, you'll see that there's language in there on having written stewardship and forest management plans, and also the use of the fees that are deposited in special revenue fund. Section 4 there's some changes that came with the amendment that have to do with the fees collected under Chapter 84. And this is something I'm sure that we'll have discussion not only from perspectives from the Department of Natural Resources, but I think also Wayne Brandt is here from the timber producers out there that will probably want to have a chance to speak to that. I know he was here before.
Yes,
he is still here. Section 5 has to do with the timber sales. Just some clarifying language that no tract should be sold to any person other than the purchaser whose name was on the bid sheet. There's also language in there that's part of the that is also part of the fee restructuring there too. Section 6 has to do with the safety training, workers' comp, and environmental training to for starting operations. And this language does exclude the smaller timber operators that we typically call the mom-and-pop operations. Section 8 has to do with the notice of operations. Section 9 was deleted. Section 10 is the liquidated damages. And that is basically clarifying language too. Section 11 is a permitting language. Section 12 has to do with lands and minerals, and this is more definitive language on exploratory boring for. Gemstones, basically, and some minerals out there, including graphite, epitite, and diamonds out there too. And Section 13 would be the repealer language. So, with that, Mr. Chairman and members, it's kind of a quick overview of this bill, but we have good people here to answer specific questions to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to answer this, it's clear my mind. On page, top page 3, it's use of state forest land fees and establishing fees. We're establishing a fee, and when I read through there, you've identified, and maybe you've identified everything that should be identified. I'm not sure about that. I just question it when you start getting down to very specific things. Maybe there could be some language that would be all-inclusive as long as it's not damaging to the environment, something like that, for a fee instead of one by one, and leaving some out.
Representative Pennis, what this is they listed all of these that they're currently already collecting fees for.
Okay.
And they want it in statute that the commissioner can set these fees and collect these fees. It's not really in statute right now. And somebody can explain if I'm wrong or explain it better. But they're already collecting these fees for these issues. We're not establishing a new fee.
It's just the language is. You're correct, Mr. Chairman. It's literally just physically listing those.
We did this a couple of years ago in a bill that I had, too, or maybe it was last year.
Yeah.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. You're correct. Basically, what the commissioner suggested was that if we want to have events occurring on state forests, that we should have a more standardized approach to it, number one, to setting fees and collecting those. And secondly, is that we ought to be more consistent in how we're applying those fees across the state from one state forest to the next. So if we have some sort of an event up in Park Rapids area and it's a similar event over in Cloquet, there's not as much discretion, if you will, with the area forest supervisors out here who are responsible right now for assessing how much of a fee to collect and getting those fees in. So this basically legislates something that we should probably be doing a better job of and taking a more standardized approach with stuff, and then also dedicating the money back so that we can spend it back for mitigation efforts if necessary, especially on roads and things like that that might be damaged with some sort of an event.
Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the only, you know, although it specifies it, and I know the commissioner likes to have everything written down, but, you know, we've got your interpretation of a large horse trail ride, commercial uses, fees are not subject to the rulemaking provision, so literally you can put the fees where you want. Am I wrong? Maybe I am. This is a sincere question. I'm not being snotty.
Mr. Thomason.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pennis, no, you're correct. We already have different fees set. Usually these are minimal fees for holding the event. And then what we will do is collect a bond as well to make sure that if we have to do any damage mitigation, that we have something there to allow for that to occur, to pay for that to occur. And we just basically want to make sure that we can continue to do that, but do it within the legislative authority that you provide us with this legislation.
Okay. Representative McNamara, have you looked at Section 3?
How many places do you need for?
3.
You
had another question, but...
I might have missed something here. Mr. Chair, thank you. My question, and again, I echo Representative Pennis's comments. I don't mean this to be snotty. is that the same word? anyway, Assistant Director Tomlinson, does DNR have the ability to charge a fee for people that erect permanent deer stands on state forest land? I'm serious. Would there ever be the possibility? Could the commissioner start to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we have not given any consideration to that particular activity as something that we would collect a fee for.
All right, thank you. I will study Section 3, Mr. Chair.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question back to the establishing fees. Just when it talks about the motorcycle, snowmobile, sports car rallies, races, or enduros, do you actually have sports car rallies, races, or enduros in state forest land?
Mr. Chair, members, only infrequently. Folks have come to us. There's one in particular that happens about every year up in Park Rapids area. I believe it's in the Paul Bunyan State Forest, where a group of... I believe it's sport car rally folks that come through and want to hold an event, if you will, in the state forest on a certain weekend. And we have worked with that group for probably a decade or more in helping them host that event in such a way that it doesn't put out the rest of the public too much, and that they can hold their event and reach the objectives that they want to. And it's become a cooperative effort that we've kind of worked with. But there, I want to emphasize that that's the only one, frankly, that I'm aware of where there's a motorcycle.
Have some copy.
Follow up on that. Thank you. I guess I'm just wondering, to me it's a little bit different to maybe have a sports car event that you get to see your sports car and it's in a forest kind of land. But the races part, I guess I'm a little concerned that environmentally that's not necessarily conducive to... what you want to have in the forest land?
Ms. Thomason?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, we wouldn't do it if we felt there was going to be environmental damage that we couldn't mitigate in some way or avoid occurring in the first place, I guess, is the main thing. That's why, for example, with that particular situation, we might require them to put hay bales along on trees or something like that where we don't want the trees scarred up if they should bounce off it. Or we don't want to have the roads ruined and left in a bad state. We want to make sure that we have a bond of some sort in place that will allow us to go in and have the damage repaired. So they basically carry the tab on it, the group, whoever it is. And likewise, that, I want to emphasize, that's just one example that I'm aware of. It's the only example that I'm aware of. There's others. I know there's in southeastern Minnesota, there's a group of folks that come in and do a big horse event one weekend of the year down there in the R.J. Dorr Memorial Forest. And there's other things like that. This is meant to kind of cover that whole gamut of
actually live on
activity.
That land that has the horse trail, but
sure.
Or I have property there. But I guess just one final question, Mr. Chair.
No problem.
Is just so do people come to you and they get a permit, or what's the permitting process then in order to be able to do it? And then could you briefly describe that?
Mr. Chair, members, we have what's referred to as a special use permit. That could be anything from giving a permit to an individual to go in and use an ATV to cross forest lands to trap minnows in the spring or trap leeches in the spring and take them out of leech ponds somewhere out in state forest land. Or it could be another example of working with an outfit like this, folks that want to put on a race and provided that, you know, they come to us and they have the right types of liability insurance and the bonding in place and those sorts of things like that, that we could work with them. Mr. Chair, I emphasize, it's not something that we advertise, you know, but when people do come to us and want to work with us and try and pull some sort of special event like that, then we will issue that special use permit with them. Mm-hmm. Basically, what this will do is help us put in statute that that's okay to do that, to issue that special use permit, and help us establish those fees and schedule for collecting the money.
Further questions? Representative McNamara, Hall, Section 3.
Well, I have some questions about Section 3. I'm glad the assistant director's down there. Have we had a problem with people that own over 1,000 acres wanting to know how they can get your help? Or why are we limiting somebody that owns 1,000 acres or more?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the 1,000-acre limitation has been in there for, I think, at least 25 years. It's as long as I can remember. That's always been there. I want to emphasize all we're doing. Basically, we do not provide management assistance to those folks that own more than 1,000 acres, because those folks that own more than 1,000 should be going to consultants or industrial foresters or otherwise and trying to get their management assistance from them. That's a decision that the legislature made probably back, and I think it dates back into the early 80s or perhaps the late 70s, that 1,000-acre limitation. Matter of fact, I think at one point it might have been 500 acres and it was moved up, but I don't recall that for sure. But I want to emphasize that Section 3, basically all that's doing is clarifying that tree planting activities and written forest stewardship planning activities on private lands are necessary services that we feel to promote the maximum sustained use of private forest land, and this is the key on this, is that the fees that we collect for those services are deposited into a special revenue fund and then directed back to us for those specific activities. So it's kind of an revolving type of an account there. Yeah. Now, all this just clarifies things for us that we can spend the money back on both of those activities, and not just on timber sale assistance to landowners and otherwise.
I'm okay.
Okay. Any further questions? Or is that pop?
I have a question. I'm not on this section, though. Section 5. Can I ask a question?
Anything on the bill.
Okay. Section 5, it says, it's Part D, I guess, where it says if the purchaser fails to make the down payment, the purchaser is liable for the payment to the state and the commissioner. The commissioner may offer the timber for sale to the next highest bidder. Is that so potentially you could get paid twice for the timber, or is that It says that they are liable. I'm just wondering if that's the intent or did
well,
you...
Representative Poppy, that's current language. That's mm-hmm. not changing. You just want to know an explanation of current statute?
Oh,
we're not changing anything there.
Okay. I must be misreading it then. It's underlined as it's new.
I thought you said...
I think it's...
Oh, page 4.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I thought you said B. You're saying E.
E.
Oh. Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
I should have used the page maybe. Well, it's not...
All right.
So it's underlined as new, so...
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, yes, when someone gives us a 15% down payment, and I'm going to look for our timber sale experts in the audience to correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my understanding is that when they give us 15% down, they sign the contract. They basically bought the rights to that timber, and they sign in a contract saying that they're going to harvest it in a certain amount of time. And if it isn't harvested, they can be liable for the value of the standing timber. But we don't exercise that option unless it's some very extenuating circumstance that they should have been in there and gotten it out or something like that. But basically, they would forego that 15% down payment. We would then turn around and sell that timber to the next person that wanted it, and yes, they would forego that 15%.
That would be out of anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, that would...
Representative Blaine?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, that's what they would forego, not the total cost of the contract, but the 15% down payment. I mean, it's no different than if you contract with somebody to do some work and you pay so much down or so much up front and then you don't deliver, you forego that right to that 15% that you put down, and Department of Natural Resources then, you know, is going to look at getting that goal accomplished if it's harvesting this timber off of this piece of property. They will collect money on that again, and yes, they would collect, they could possibly collect the 15% plus that next highest bid on that timber sale too.
Can I just ask to clarify that a little bit more? Because as I read this, maybe it's just the way I'm reading it, but it seems to say if they fail to make the down payment, the purchaser is liable for the payment, not indicating that it's the 15% down payment that they're liable for, but it may be the full payment. So I just wonder if that maybe could be clarified a little bit, or maybe it's just the way I'm reading it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Doug Ford. I'm the timber sales supervisor for the DNR. I just got to get my head around that question very quickly, but basically, if you renege on your bid and do not provide that down payment day of sale, you would be liable for that down payment, and then that means we'd have to go to court mm-hmm. to prove that you were intentionally trying to do something wrong. I've been around for a little over 9,000 timber sales. In my reign, if you will, as timber sale supervisor, I've never seen this happen. Never. And it's just a continuation of the same language that you would see on page 3, paragraph B, line 18. It's the same thing on an oral bid or a sealed bid.
I'm just wondering about that word down. Yeah, I mean, just to clarify it, if that would make any sense to just say that they're liable for the down payment. Is that okay?
That's fine.
If we're putting new language in, I mean, it just seems like it would make sense to try to have it clean so you understand.
Representative Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe to the testifier, when we look at on page 4, line 4.4 that Representative Poppy is talking about, when you reference in the second part of that line where it says the purchaser is liable for the payment to the state, is the word the payment referencing the total contract payment?
Mr. Board Chairman, Representative Cox, no. It's just representing the down payment, okay. That 15% of the appraised.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for clarification's sake, if it's all right with the department, I would like to make an oral amendment to House Bill 3056 and on line 4.4 I would like to insert the word down between the words the and the word payment at towards the end of line 4.4.
That's necessary. Ms. Ford, what do you think?
Sounds like a good change to me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All in favor of Representative Blaine's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Any further questions? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3 where we're we're looking at on 3056 on page 3, line 3.7, where it talks about the receipts to special revenue fund. Fees collected shall be credited to special fund and annually appropriated to the commissioner. What are the precedences that we have and examples within a department where this is done?
Ms. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, the nursery program, the funds that we receive for selling tree seedlings, of course, coming into the nursery, and it's, I believe, what you'd refer to as a statutory appropriation where the nursery just operates in within whatever is there. Those dollars roll forward. We have some other smaller accounts like that within the department as well, within the division. I'm trying to think, with our resource assessment shop, there's a couple of smaller accounts for selling aerial photography, for example, that the dollars that we receive for that go back into an account. I believe that's in statute. Yeah. And those are just annually appropriated back. So this is one where the dollars are currently already appropriated back via statutory appropriation, if I'm not mistaken. I don't believe we come over and ask for you to reappropriate those each biennium, but that we have worked within that small amount of money that's in there each year. And this is just confirming how we spend the dollars and what we use them on, I believe, is more to the point with this.
Representative, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking the question is that I have to go back and look at the language, but I was aware of some of those other accounts, but I thought the language was specific to keep those monies to that specific purpose, where this one seems to be just appropriated to the commissioner. It looks like the commissioner has a little slush fund going here. So I'm wondering what if this is new policy or is this current policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, perhaps it should say something like appropriate back to the commissioner for the purposes from which it was collected, okay, or something like we have with the other country. That's what the intent was to do.
Ms. Tomlinson,
whether or not we have it worded right here or not.
Could you look at that? This bill's going to be coming to your committee anyway, Representative Osmond.
Yeah. We're
going to be sending it
that
to GovOps, and then it's going to be coming to your committee, so we'll
sounds good.
Hopefully they can straighten that out by the time it gets
we'll
to your
do
committee.
That.
Okay, good. Any further questions from committee members? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Thank you for allowing me to speak, Mr. Chairman. We support this legislation. We appreciate the author bringing it forward and him working with us and with the department. There were several concerns that we had about the bill. Most of them were taken care of in the amendment that was adopted. I would just note that the increase in down payments in Section 5, that the amendment particularly is an improvement on what was originally proposed. We can live with what's in the amendment. We're not wildly enthusiastic about having to put additional money down on timber sales, but my organization has reviewed this and we can live with the amendment as drafted. I would suggest that you may hear from the committee, may hear from members, may hear from some timber purchasers, particularly smaller loggers, that will have reluctance on moving from the 15% of appraised to 15% of bid, because it will involve putting more money up front on a timber sale. You know, the judgment And I think that's out there on a policy basis is how much security is adequate for the state when they're making these transactions. You know, we believe that that every nickel ought to be paid for on every timber sale, and every contract ought to be enforced, that that's the only way to have a fair and level playing field on stumpage. But how much security is enough is really a judgment for you all to make.
Very good. Thank you. Anything further? Any questions? Anything further, Representative Blaine? Okay, Representative Blaine moves that House File 3056 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Veterans Affairs. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Okay, next, Representative Blaine, we're going to take your House File 3039.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chair and members, House File 3039 is the language of this bill is very short. This is very short and sweet and up front, and this is a good piece of legislation. I would, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask that we move House File 3039 and have this bill sent to the floor with hopes that we can act on this immediately on the floor. Members, this House File 3039 is a bill that gives the commissioner the ability to extend the permitting time for timber harvest because of adverse climatic conditions. And if we've got too much snow up in northern Minnesota, and we've got our foresters up there who are trying to finish harvesting off of land off of a permit, and are not able to get out into the woods because of too much snow, or this maybe trying to finish harvesting and we've got all this snow melting this spring, do not want to go back into the woods and rip up the roadways or rip up the woods because of that. This gives the commissioner the ability to give an extension to those permits in what could be the best management practices for these forests, but still being able to keep good relations with our loggers out there who we depend on so dearly. So, Mr. Chair, that's in my estimation the crux of this bill.
Very good, Representative Wagenius. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually glad to know what your intention is on this bill, that you want to give an extension if there's too much snow. And I would suggest that we amend the bill to say that, because the way it's written, it says widespread abnormal climatic conditions. Well, now that we're in global warming, we have widespread abnormal climatic conditions. So this bill is so broad that it allows the commissioner to give call an emergency permanently. And I think it's way overdrawn. I mean, I couldn't figure out what in the world this bill was about when I first read it. If it is too much snow, that's okay. We can write that. But right now, widespread abnormal climatic conditions. So we have a warm winter, and everything is mucky out there. We can already declare an emergency. The commissioner can extend and let people harvest in the mud. That is what this bill says. And I think we need to revisit the language.
Representative Lane.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not sure if we want to get that defined with this language. In my mind, I don't look at the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources just running this around the clock, that because of changes in global climatic conditions, that we're just going to now have the Commissioner of DNR just extend you any permits forever out there. you know, I use the snow as an example, but we could also have this because of flooding, because of the ground may not be froze hard enough, or other types of conditions out there too. And I think that we have to be able to give the department at least enough leeway to act on this, or we're going to be back addressing this continually. But I'll also let Mr. Tomlinson give the department's perspective on this too.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, members, to put this in perspective, we need to keep in mind that you know, we'll probably harvest about 800,000 cords each year off of state forest lands throughout the state. And the vast majority of that is harvested in the winter months of the year. Most of that timber is only accessible via frozen ground conditions. This year, we had an unusually mild December and January, and we anticipated that probably as much as 60 to 70% of the harvest that should have occurred during those months did not occur during those months. Now, that's problematic for a lot of folks, ourselves included, who are counting on those sales to be sold and the timber harvested and us going back in for reforestation or otherwise next year and those sorts of things. But it's also more difficult for the operators of the sales, the loggers, who are in the fifth year currently of their contract, and they have to have the wood out, say, by the end of March or by sometime here in the next several months. And they haven't been able to get in there because of those abnormally, unseasonably warm winter months that we had at the beginning of this season. That is the crux of this bill, is to try and get at that problem that occurs only occasionally in the state. Great snowfalls could be a problem in the future. Unseasonably warm weather would more likely be more apt to be something that would occur, or significantly wet weather. But we really rely on frozen ground conditions to get back in to a lot of those sites, and that's why we need this legislation through.
Representative Guinness.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not objecting here to being able to change under certain conditions. What I'm objecting to here is the language of the bill, which says widespread abnormal climatic conditions. That is so broadly written that from now on we will be in widespread abnormal climatic conditions. So what we have is a piece of a bill that eats the whole thing up. That happens sometimes, and all you have to do is narrow your language. And that is the problem I'm trying to address. It's not, if we had too much snow and we had to extend the permit, that's okay. But let's not write it so broadly that the commissioner can pretty much, I mean, we don't want to be calling this King Marion's bill. We really want to have something that is based in fact and not just in somebody's determination that something is abnormal. Because from now on, we'll be abnormal.
Mr. Chair, members, let me be clear that the Division of Forestry, the Department of Natural Resources, are not interested in extending permits beyond the life of the permit. We're very stingy with that, and the operators appreciate that, and that's been our operation. But we feel that the qualifier in here, you're right, it, widespread abnormal climatic conditions is a fairly open statement. But we also follow that up, that prevent the proper and timely harvesting of existing permits for standing timber. And that's where we try to narrow it down to a very specific purpose for which we're trying to accomplish here. You know, we thought it was, it allows the commissioner the flexibility to determine when is an event impacting the removal of standing timber. That's if it near the end of its permit.
Representative Osmond, to this point.
Okay. When you're describing the reason for this, everything seemed to focus on the surface of the forest, whether it's frozen or whether it's too soft or whether it's flooded or whatever. Is that really the focus of this? Is the surface, that the surface be of proper condition?
Ms. Thomason.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, certainly the timber sale cannot occur unless the conditions are there to allow access into the sites. And so if the conditions, if we don't have frozen ground, which we didn't have in December and most of January this winter, then that puts everything back relative to the operators being able to get in and remove the timber that was scheduled to be removed in the 5 or 6 month winter harvest season that we're looking at. But I'm not sure if I answered your question.
My question is that your concern really is the surface that you're trying to drive on may not be of proper condition to allow for the forester. Is that's really the surface that's the main concern? But the reason I'm asking that is because right now you've got this based upon climatic conditions, but if you did that widespread abnormal soil conditions or widespread abnormal forest surface conditions or whatever the proper terminology would be, but focusing it on your problem, I think would narrow it down, like Representative Guineas is talking about, get you away from kind of an innocuous term that kind of means everything to really the problem that you're trying to address.
Ms. Thomason?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Doug Ford to respond to Representative Osmond's on this.
Ford?
Thank you, Bob. Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond. The surface is the primary culprit. But we have had, in my career, which is 33 years in length, soon to be 34, we have had fire, the 1976-77 fire season that drove everybody out of the woods, the fishermen, the hunters, and the loggers. And that was extreme drought and abnormal, based on standard Weather Bureau definitions. And this year, and I firmly in the camp that believes in the global warming thing, but the global warming thing, by Weather Bureau definition, you know, it changes what is the norm over time, so that what I think we would all agree is abnormal today would become normal at some future point. Yeah, predominantly the surface, but it's surface conditions. But what is it? Too much snow or too much water or not enough frost or too doggone dry?
Sure, if it's abnormal, or if it's widespread and it's abnormal, I think it would cover those things. I think the word climatic is the problem, because essentially with that word in there, you have year-round condition that allows you to declare an emergency. That's the frustration is needs to be narrowed down a little bit more, but certainly cover everything that you talked about. I think everybody wants to be able to work on that, but not just because we're having some climatic condition that happens to be world widespread, that all of a sudden that means you have to declare an emergency.
Representative Blaine, would you like to get together with the folks from the DNR and maybe work out some different language? We could lay the bill over and come back to it after we get done with Representative Osmond's bill. How would you like to do that? Would you like to get together and talk about that, Mr. Ford and Ms. Thomason? Take a little time rather than make a snap judgment right now.
That's the desire of the committee.
Why don't you do that? We'll lay House File 3039 over for possible consideration later on in this committee. Representative Osmond, we'll take up your bill now. House File 3012. Representative Osmond, House Bill 3012. We're looking at this to be recommended to pass and be referred to your committee on the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is one that allows for some modification of the statutes that deal with state park permits, and I'd like to have the director of the parks, of state parks, explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Is this the first time before this committee, please, sir?
Mr. Chairman, no, this is my second year here.
Okay.
Thank you. My name is Cortland Nelson. I'm director of state parks. We have a set of changes that we're recommending this year, and these are all related to either creating new interest in state parks and or making it easier for our visitors to access our facilities. The first change is that for a variety of reasons we are recommending a reduction in our daily permit fee from $7 to $5. The background for that is basically we have had an expectation when the fee was raised in 2003 that our annual permit sales would rise, meaning that with a higher cost per daily fee, that more of our visitors would purchase the annual fee, which sells for $25. The daily fee sells for $7. And as I said, the thought was that this would convert to an increase in annual permit sales. That has not happened. It has remained relatively flat. Part of our issues are that we do get what we call turnarounds. People come in and they find out that $7 is maybe more than they thought, or it's a little inconvenient for that cash exchange, and they turn around and leave. That certainly isn't all of the answer. Also, around particularly the regional parks in the Twin Cities area in Duluth and Rochester, they have gone to a free park system, many of them, so there are no fees associated with daily entrance. Our thoughts here are that we would like to, knowing that we would initially have a loss per visitor, if you will, or per vehicle, but that this could be balanced out with a very aggressive marketing campaign, and that we can simply get more people to come to state parks. We believe that we have a good opportunity to get a hold of new customers, to contact new user groups, and that we will use this as one of those incentives. Your predecessors and my predecessors for many decades have talked about the issue of a fee to get into state parks. Should there be one? If there is one, what should it be? There have been studies from certain organizations within either the legislative body or at the university level that has said here are some revenue opportunities that you could capture in state parks to pay more of your own way. The other side of that spectrum, as you know, is that parks should be relatively inexpensive for everybody to use, at least at that day use level. If you're going to have a camper cabin or if you're going to have a camping experience, then you would expect to be paying more. But to get into the park, that should be a relatively inexpensive opportunity. So we would like to try that. That's our purpose for reducing the fee, is to have an opportunity for us to be as easy as possible for current and potential customers to get in, to use our park system, and hopefully to become lifelong customers of us. And there are associated to that the appropriate reductions for group day use also. The third part of our fee proposal is a motorcycle pass. And this is to target a specific group of users that, from our research, shows is underutilizing the state park system. These are the over-the-road riders. There are 160,000 plus of them in Minnesota. There's certainly no reason that they couldn't buy a state park pass, but it has everything to do with a group of people that we feel, if we approach them in the positive way, that they will find us to be an option for them on recreationally, a place that they can come visit. They do have a set of issues with regards to the sticker which you place on a vehicle. And you may not remember, but last year in the session you changed a law which allows the commissioner to pick another option rather than the sticker that goes in the window. Because if you have spent $20,000 or more on a motorcycle, you don't want to take a piece of anything and stick it on your bike. And so there are several options, and if you're interested, Mr. Chairman, I can show you what we're thinking about in working with the motorcycle community. That would be an option to that sticker. But the idea is to have a little bit of a reduction. We all like to have a little incentive to make a purchase, to make a positive contact with those motorcycle groups, clubs, and individuals. We've been meeting with the various user groups in the state, with the safety groups, with the Victory Motorcycle folks, and talk about how to get integrated into their community. If we were able to get 10% of those 160,000 riders to purchase an annual pass, that will, in fact, offset what would be the loss of our daily fee reduction. So that's how those numbers, in theory, tie together. It still requires us to do a lot of work on our marketing, getting a hold of leaders of special interest groups. But we are excited about this. And I would think if this works, that in a year or two, I would be back with an anxious opportunity to show you another group of special interests that we might be interested in, whether it would be birders or whether it would be some other group that we can approach in a marketing effort to try and do a better job of making people aware of state parks. Mr. Chairman, the other components of this bill are really to make the visit of the state park easier for our patrons. We have a specific issue at Sudan Mine where we really have an oddity in our system in that it is the mining experience that is the attraction. That is the park. We don't have a campground. We have a very small, modest picnic area. And what happens now is that you come in, you park, you walk in, you pay your fee to tour the mine, which is a separate fee, and then we require you to buy an annual or a daily pass, which you then walk back out to the parking lot to put on your car and then come back in and go on the tour. And what we are proposing, for all of the obvious reasons, is that this park, we eliminate that requirement for a daily permit, since there is no purpose at being at Sudan other than to take part in the mine tour and those associated activities. We will then raise our dollar, our fee at the mine by a dollar, and we believe that these will balance out. Many of the park visitors who come already have an annual pass in their car, so it's a non-issue for them. Others, if they're interested in buying an annual pass, we will continue to sell them. But this is really a convenience to those park patrons at a park, one of a kind in our system, where the only thing you do is go on a tour. And then finally, for those RVers who come in, we currently require a charge for both a RV and the vehicle that is being towed. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that, many of the over-the-road RVers tow a small vehicle behind their RV, and we require in our statutes that you get an annual pass for both. But we're proposing here is that we give you a courtesy permit for that second vehicle, the one that you would disattach from your RV, and as you would go into town or you would go and do whatever you're going to do with your over-the-road vehicle, that you would simply use a courtesy pass for that and not charge for that second vehicle. We have had some anecdotal but very strong information from the RV manufacturers as well as from their special interest groups that this is a something that ticks them off. And every time they pay it, they mention it. And as we looked at it and evaluated, we thought this is a pretty smart thing if we could get your support on this, strictly for the users of those RV folks who come into the park and have tended to be very strong and loyal patrons of our system for a long time. Mr. Chairman, that's all I would have initially, if I could answer any questions.
Very good. Representative Pena.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to see you're targeting another group. And I would also ask you, how about walk-ins? Do they pay any fee? And should we target the bikers and hikers? Are bikes, other than motorcycles, being charged, a park sticker or something to put on them?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chair, we have, first of all, we pay totally for state trails, state walking trails, and I am all for walking. I do a lot of it. We pay for those trails. They are paid trails. Then when it comes to maintenance, we pay for maintenance. Okay? Now, as a motorcycle owner and rider, I'll pay the darn fee. But it's another group. Let's get something other than a motorized group for a change. It just would be a breath of fresh air.
Well, Representative Pennis, I understand where you're coming from, but right now they're paying when they come into State Park anyway. They have to pay at least a daily pass to get in. And this is would provide them for an annual pass.
For $20.
And
the pass. And they're paying now what?
Right.
$25.
Yep.
And, but we are also... aren't we changing the other fee? Or is that just daily?
We're lowering the daily fee.
So you're lowering the fee on motorcycles so you can get more of them.
That's true.
Otherwise, they have to pay $25 for, like, a car would pay $25. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right. This bill is reducing the fees in a number of different locations.
I stand corrected.
Appreciate your support.
Representative Welty. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the motorcycle fee. You have one motorcycle at $20, and I'm assuming that if they're a husband and a wife that ride separately, they both pay the $20. And do you anticipate any issues with that when somebody might come into a state park and say, well, I know I can buy a $25 permit, and for that second car in my family, I only pay $18. So motorcycles, why don't we have a reduced fee for that second motorcycle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a very good suggestion.
I have to say, Mr. Chair, my husband also owns a motorcycle. I wouldn't ride with him. I'd gladly pay that two extra dollars.
Whatever.
Any further questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question. Last fall, my family, we went up to Split Rock Lighthouse, and while standing in line, we watched somebody really kind of lose their temper with the staff over the fee, just talking about the fee. And I talked with the staff afterwards, and they said that that was fairly common, that they take a lot of anger. And I just wonder if you could elaborate, or if you've tracked, or just what you're hearing from your employees. I mean, I think this is a good thing if it can help reduce some of those confrontations. The staff are very professional, but it was kind of sad to see, because they were doing their job and had to deal with a lot of anger from the public. So I'd just like some elaboration on that. And
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the subsets of the bill dealing with the RV pass and certainly the reduction in daily fee, I think, addresses that issue. I don't know what specifically was talked about that day. As a general rule around the upper Midwest, we have our camping fees are on the higher end. Our daily fees are in the middle, knowing that at least three states in the upper Midwest don't charge a daily fee. So from somebody who is used to that absence of the fee for a daily admission, Iowa, Missouri would be two examples of that, then they may have a comment about that. My personal experience is that our fees are relatively fair, should I say, for the service that we provide, and we all have examples of what you could do with $7 or $5 in any situation, at a convenience store to get into a movie and all of that. I tend to think of that entrance fee, though, as an opportunity to get a lifelong customer and somebody who likes what we do, they likes the service we provide, and, of course, always has a great appreciation for Minnesota's natural resources, or at least give me a shot at getting them appreciation for that. So I see this, the barrier, if we can reduce it a little on that issue, we'll help solve that, but every weekend I'm sure we have people who the assessment that we charge for camping, the assessment we charge for day use, generally there isn't the problem with the fee that we have for our reservation system. They have already paid that, and we don't deal with that at the point of when they arrive at the park. As a summary answer to you, I would say we have the typical kind of problems that come about when we're stopping somebody to take money from them. hopefully this set of issues in this bill will eliminate some of those.
I could follow up with a request for personal privilege. That I have a couple of constituents here.
Well, I was going to recognize you for that a little later, but go ahead. Okay. That's fine.
I have two constituents here, two fine young gentlemen, Sam Hansen and Pat Persons from St. Thomas Academy. This is their first committee meeting, so welcome them to the committee. They're learning about
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a point of clarification. I know when Director Nelson had his opening remarks, he mentioned something about the metro parks and that many of them are free. And actually, I'm only aware of the Three Rivers Park District, which recently switched, and they had kind of extenuating circumstances. And I think there might be one other county that has free registration or free admittance. But I know several years ago through the LCMR, there was a park study that Chairman Osmond shared. And, you know, overall, we did a lot of things to encourage metro parks to be self-supporting and look at more revenue-enhancing things. So I just wanted to be on the record that, you know, we don't want metro parks to be free if there's not another reason. But, I mean, and it's going in the direction where they're raising fees, not lowering it. So I didn't want anybody to think that we're going that way, and just had that for the record. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Nelson, a follow-up to Representative Hansen's Split Rock. I remember when we toured that for either bonding or LCMR, some of the staff mentioning his specific concerns. Do they have some special, because they seemed like they were pretty well prepared, do they have some special training? Because I thought the discussion centered around the fee that's charged to walk up the hill to the actual lighthouse. They can come in there. That state park's unique. You can get in it without paying a fee, but then you're limited. You can't walk up that hill. And do they have some good training to let the general public know the why of that, that they've already been lucky that they've got in to see this much of a state park for free, which is unusual? And I guess just a follow-up, because I know that is a serious question up there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one bit of clarification, we have seven or eight facilities around the state where we share property with the Minnesota State Historical Society. This is the icon of all of those, of course, because of the park and Split Rock facility. So it's a constant effort to try and educate for both organizations. The Minnesota Historical Society gets all kinds of questions about can we picnic and can we camp and how do we do that, because we went by their facility on the way in. We get those same set of questions in the reverse, and we try as hard as we can to make it clear what is an opportunity to go to the lighthouse run by the Historical Society, and when you are then on park property and are going to consume our facilities, if you will, that where you need to have that park pass. And it works quite well. I tend to believe that for as complicated as that probably is at that place, Representative, that we probably do a pretty good job in the main of making it. I would hope that someday we can clear that up statewide. And I have been having very positive meetings, as an aside, with the State Historical Society on trying to solve the other seven and to prepare ourselves for some good dialogue on Split Rock, which is just more complicated because of all the people and the other issues that are involved. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Osmond moves that House File 3012 be recommended and passed and be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture, Environment, and Natural Resources Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Bill has moved to your committee, Mr. Representative Osmond.
Thank you.
Representative Blaine, are we ready to go?
All right, we are, sir.
Sounds good. We'll bring back up House File 3039, was it?
Yep.
3039. I'm guessing you might have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an oral amendment to House File 3039. Real simple. Members, we're going to change three words in three different places. On line 1.8, we're going to change the word climatic to surface. On line 1.9, climatic to surface. On line 1.14, climatic to surface. And
and in hopes that this will bring us about to a better situation. Representative Wagenius, you seem to be happier with this?
Representative Wagenius?
Thank you. It certainly narrows the bill and doesn't have this ability to make King Miriam out of somebody I don't think really wants to be king.
Okay. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Blaine, I assume we would also change in the title on line 1.3.
Yes. Representative Cox, thank you. We'll make it 4 to go.
Okay. Thank you.
Everybody understand the amendment? All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Blaine moves that House File 3039 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the General Register. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Your bill is moved to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Okay, members, our next meeting will be next Thursday. It'll be next Thursday. We don't have anything happening here next Monday and Tuesday. So next Thursday, not after the State of the State, but after session. We will be meeting 1 half hour after session next Thursday. With that, members, meeting adjourned.